Okay, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. We are joined once again by Dr. Michael Egnor, and we are discussing his contribution to the volume Minding the Brain. In the previous episode, we discussed all the ways that contemporary neuroscience has disconfirmed materialism, and Mike is really the guy to have this conversation with. And in today's episode, we're actually going to do a little FAQ. But before we get to that, we wanted to wrap up some of the other criticisms of materialism. Mike, you mentioned that you had a few more shots to take towards the materialist worldview, and I want to make sure you get all of them out before we move on here. So, yeah, please.
it's a deep well. Another fascinating set of experiments that I think really casts a great doubt on materialism is research that started with a guy named Adrian Owen, who is a neuropsychologist originally from Cambridge, England, who now is actually in the U.S., and he's a great scientist. And in 2006, he wrote an article in the New England Journal of Medicine called Detecting Awareness in the Vegetative State. And it was a landmark article, really shook the medical world. And the story behind it was there is a condition called persistent vegetative state. Persistent vegetative state is a horrible coma, and is the deepest level of coma, just one step above being brain dead. And it means that your brain has been almost completely demolished. And the assumption was made that your brain damage is so profound that there's no mental state. That is, you're a vegetable. That is, that you don't have any thoughts, don't have anything, you're just a vegetable. And it's tragic. It happens to people, for example, Terry Schiavo.
I remember, all that was
in persistent vegetative state. And I've treated scores of patients in persistent vegetative state. So Owen asked the question, are we so sure that they don't have a mind? How do we know? And part of that is that when your brain is damaged that badly, you can't communicate well. You're partially or totally paralyzed. You can't speak. So how could you tell if somebody really had mental states? They can't communicate them to you. So Owen did some fascinating research. He took a young woman, she was in her 30s, who had had a car accident several years before with massive brain damage and was diagnosed as persistent vegetative state by very reliable doctors. And he put her in an MRI machine, and he did a kind of an MRI on her called functional MRI imaging. And functional MRI imaging looks at blood flow in areas of the brain that corresponds to brain activity. So you get these little areas that light up that tell you that the brain is working in certain areas and certain patterns. So, and she didn't have much of a brain, but the brain she had, which was massively damaged, you could do functional MRI imaging on. So he put her in the machine, he put headphones on her, and he asked her while he was doing the MRI, imagine that you're playing tennis, or think about walking across the room, think about your family. Mm-hmm. And he found that her brain kind of lit up, kind of a pattern. It was kind of interesting. So he took a bunch of normal volunteers, I think 15 of them, and asked exactly the same questions. And their brains lit up in exactly the same way, the same patterns. So he said, wow, it seems like this woman understood what I was saying to her. So because he's a good scientist, he realized that there's a scientific flaw in that. And the flaw is that it may be that she and the volunteers were just hearing sounds, and it was the sound that was making the brain light up, not any actual understanding.
Understand, sure, right. Mm-hmm.
So he was very clever. So he put her back in the machine, and he asked her the same questions, but he scrambled the words. So the words didn't make any sense. So instead of saying, imagine you're walking across a room, he would say, room walking, imagine you're across. That was just nonsense. Mm-hmm. And her brain was silent. Her brain only lit up when the questions made sense.
When they were intelligible.
Yes. And the volunteers had the same thing. So his research has been extended by a lot of people, and people are finding the same thing. It's now possible with about 40% of people in persistent vegetative state, the deepest level of coma, just one step above brain death, to converse with them using functional MRI imaging. And there have been people who, for example, you can ask them yes or no questions. Is your brother's name Philip? Do you like pizza? And they get the right answers. So what that implies is that there's a disconnect, not complete, but significant, between the mind, particularly the capacity for abstract thought, and the brain itself. These are people whose brains are practically destroyed, but they can answer questions about their brother.
Right.
So the other line of research that is absolutely fascinating, and that, you know, we could do, you know, 12 hours on, is near-death experiences.
Oh, I was hoping we would get to this. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Very excited to hear your take on NDEs.
Yeah, the near-death experiences are, first of all, they're very common. There's an estimated, at least in modern times, tens of millions of people have had near-death experiences. It's surprisingly common. And there's quite a lot of literature on it. There are several scientific journals that are devoted entirely to it. The most famous near-death experience in modern times was of a woman named Pam Reynolds. And Reynolds was a woman in her 30s. Who had a aneurysm, a weak spot in a blood vessel at the base of her brain that was about to rupture. And she was getting headaches and not feeling well. Went to the doctor. They found the aneurysm. The problem is that where the aneurysm was located was too critical a part of the brain to treat surgically. This was back in the early 1990s. We've made a lot of advances since then. And nowadays, we can treat aneurysms like hers pretty easily. But back then, we couldn't. So the only hope she had was there was a neurosurgeon in Phoenix named Bob Spetzler, who was really the best aneurysm surgeon in the world. And he had developed a technique for difficult, complex aneurysms where he would take a patient, he would put them under anesthesia, he would open their head, he would then drive their body temperature down to about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and then he would put them on a heart-lung machine and stop their heart. So their blood flow was completely stopped. They were semi-frozen, so they could be without blood for longer without brain damage. And then he would tip the operating table up, drain the blood out of their brain, and then go in and fix the aneurysm. And then when the aneurysm was fixed, it would take him like 30 minutes of sewing and fixing. Then he would start the blood flow again and warm them up and bring them back to life. So it allowed him to do the work on the aneurysm that he couldn't have done if the blood was circulating in their brain.
Sure.
So she went into surgery, and surgery went well. Took like 6 hours. In the recovery room, Spetzler, who I know he's a great neurosurgeon, went in to see her, and he asked her how she was doing. She said fine, you know, and she said, you know, I watched the whole operation. So he thought she was joking, and she said, no, I saw the surgery. And then she started describing what she saw. And she saw the real thing, meaning she saw the instruments that he was using. She knew the conversations that he was having during the surgery. She knew the music that was playing on the radio in the operating room. She knew the people in the room that she had no other way of knowing. So she said what happened was that as soon as her heart stopped, she felt that she popped out of her body and she floated up to the ceiling. And she had a view of the whole room. She said it was beautiful. Actually, it was fascinating. She wasn't frightened. And she could watch them work. And she said she was looking down on herself on the operating table. Mm-hmm. And then she said she saw a tunnel, the proverbial tunnel.
Right.
And she felt that she was being drawn down the tunnel towards a beautiful light. She came to the other side of the tunnel. She saw this beautiful, beautiful world. Beautiful light. And she saw some dead relatives, like a dead uncle and dead aunt or something. And she wanted to stay in this beautiful place on the other end of the tunnel. And they said, no, you still have things that you need to do. You need to go back in your body.
Yeah.
So she went back and she said it was like diving into an ice bucket because her body temperature was 50 degrees.
It's so cold. Yeah.
But she actually felt the cold. And her near-death experience became very famous. It is the most carefully monitored because she was unquestionably brain dead, meaning there was no brain activity. They had electrical tests of her brain. She had things in her ears that prevented her from hearing anything in the room in the normal way. Mm-hmm. So it's the most clearly, unequivocally documented near-death experience that exists. But there have been thousands upon thousands of near-death experiences. And there's no question that if you look at them rationally, The only reasonable explanation for them is that many of them are true.
Yes.
And what fascinates me, something that I think is just a slam dunk, just slam dunk, is that as far as I know, all near-death experiences, when they encounter dead relatives or friends, they're only dead relatives or friends. That is, they never encounter living people at the other end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And there have been a number of instances in which they encountered dead people at the other end of the tunnel and they did not know they were dead.
Right.
There's a very famous case of a young woman who had surgery, I don't know, for ruptured appendix or something, and she coded, her heart stopped during the surgery, and she had a near-death experience. And she recovered from this and was talking with her father at the bedside like 12 hours after the surgery. And she said, you know, Dad, I went down this tunnel and I saw my brother at the other end. And the father said, do you mean like dead? And she said, yeah. And then the father got a phone call that he had just been killed in a car accident.
Wow.
That he was dead when she had her near-death experience, but no one knew it in the family.
Yeah.
So near-death experiences, again, if people took an objective look at the evidence, science would accept near-death experiences. That doesn't mean every single one of them is verifiable.
Right.
But there are at least hundreds that are very verifiable.
Where you have the veridical experiences.
Absolutely.
That
Absolutely.
Just do not seem susceptible to any sort of materialist explanation. And I guess my question here, mostly rhetorical, is, you know, how much evidence from, you know, contemporary neuroscience do you need, right? I mean, between everything we discussed last time with the right. epilepsy research, split brain experiments, near-death experiences.
Well, but it's not about the evidence. That is that I really believe very, very, very much so that you've heard of the Lysenko phenomenon in Russia.
No, I have not. Yeah.
There's a scientist named Lysenko. He was a biologist in the Soviet Union back during Stalin's time, and he believed in the acquisition of heritable traits by organisms just by their life. That is that you know that that if an organism had something happen to it during its life, that could be inherited and then given to offspring. And this is, of course, contrary to genetics and to what was known about biology. And however, it fit nicely in the Marxist paradigm, the idea that you know you could change society and that change would be real and would be something that would go on for eternity. So Lysenko, who was a junk scientist, he was a totally incompetent scientist, got his ideas so entrenched in Soviet science that biologists who disagreed with him were sent to gulags, and some were executed. So for a number of decades in the Soviet Union, if you were a biologist, you had to agree with Lysenko or you were toast. And it held Soviet biological science back decades. There were famines because Lysenko's ideas were wrong, and crops, you know, you couldn't grow crops that way, but like Lysenko would insist you could. And the Lysenko phenomenon goes on here as well. If scientists speak outside of the materialist paradigm, they just get run over.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with the evidence, any more than what Lysenko was saying had anything to do with evidence. It's about politics and it's about ideology, and you better toe the line or they just destroy you.
Yeah, because when you get down to the level of detail, and that's where all the good stuff is, Mike. I mean, it really seems like there's really no more breathing room for a materialist account of the human person, right? Yeah.
Precisely. So
are there any other shots, you know, against materialism that you want to take before we turn to the frequently asked questions?
No, I think this is a pretty good overview, and the frequently asked questions are pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I am utterly curious because you're somebody who has, obviously, with your background in neuroscience, but your expertise in philosophy of mind, I am sure you get all sorts of fascinating questions on a regular basis. So please, if you wouldn't mind sharing some of the more common, I think our listeners will find that to be particularly helpful.
Sure, and you're quite right. These questions come up a lot, and they're good questions. One of the questions relates to modern theories of how consciousness works. And there's a number of different modern theories as to how consciousness works. Virtually all of them, with very few exceptions, involve information processing in the cerebral cortex. That is, that consciousness is some the notion that you have all these sensory inputs, vision and hearing and smell and taste, coming in, and then your cortex kind of processes them like some computer, and that's what makes you conscious.
Sure.
The problem with that theory, and to give you an idea about how ridiculous neuroscience can be, the problem with that theory is that there are a group of people who have no cerebral cortex who are completely conscious. And this is very well documented. The condition is called hydranencephaly. And hydranencephaly is a tragic condition. It happens to children who have massive strokes in the brain during intrauterine life. So when they're born, their brain hemispheres are basically missing. And they have the brain stem and the more basic functions. And they're severely disabled. It's like severe cerebral palsy. But they're fully conscious. I mean, I've had a number of these kids, and they laugh, they cry, they don't speak really, but they're very conscious, and they love their mothers, and they're just, you know, you see them, they're sort of cute babies, and they grow up, and I've had some grow up into later childhood. So consciousness is obviously not a matter of cortical processing if you have tens of thousands of people in the world who have no cortex yet are fully conscious. And if you ask the average neuroscientist who's pushing one of their cortical processing theories of consciousness, they'll look at you like you're from Mars, you know. But there have been a few neuroscientists who have noted this. Mark Solms is one of them. S-O-L-M-S is his last name. He's a neuroscientist from South Africa. He's a very, very good neuroscientist. And he and I have some different perspectives on how consciousness works. But Mark has noted that it's not cortical. It's not on the surface of the brain because of people with hydranencephaly that they're fully conscious. They don't have a cortex.
Right.
The second question that I get a lot of almost always when I speak on this is about Phineas Gage. Phineas Gage was a railway worker back in the mid 19th century who was injured in an explosion. The explosion drove an iron spike through his brain.
Yes. Yeah. Famous incident. Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And before the accident, he was a Bible reading, God-fearing man. And after the accident, he was a little looser. He wasn't that bad, actually, but he was, he'd hit the bars occasionally. And so people say, hey, doesn't that prove that the mind comes entirely from the brain? You get a spike driven through it, you're a different person. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's nonsense. I mean, everybody knows that getting whacked in the head with an iron spike or otherwise can change you. You know, it can change you quite a bit.
A couple drinks can change you, right?
That doesn't mean that all the mind comes from the brain. Any more than just to use kind of a rough analogy, if I take my cell phone and I accidentally crush it so it stops working right, that doesn't mean that the voice in my cell phone was in the cell phone, that the person I'm talking to was located in the cell phone just because it stops working. There are more complex issues of causation involved. So no dualist would deny that getting a spike through the brain might change, for example, your emotional tone.
Right,
which
right.
Penfield would say, yeah, you know, right. You've got you're more impulsive. You have a different set of sort of emotional approaches to things. But we acknowledge that. There's no question.
And that fits well with the Thomistic dualism that you endorse.
Sure. Right. Absolutely. Uh-huh. In Thomistic dualism, emotions are what St. Thomas would call a sensitive appetite.
Right.
Meaning that they're the same thing that dogs have. For example, my dog gets extremely emotional around dinner time.
Yeah, they're bodily, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. It's a bodily aspect of the mind, which is very real, but it's different from free will, which is a very different thing. The third question that we get a lot is the mind a kind of computation?
Yes,
that is the mind like a computer? And a very popular way of looking at the relationship between the mind and the brain is that the brain is hardware and the mind is software. Basically, the mind runs on the brain like a software program runs on a computer. And that's not the case. That is that the mind is not a kind of computation at all. The reason is fairly straightforward. A computation, by definition, is the matching of an input to an output according to an algorithm. That is that you have a certain pattern of input coming into a system, and you have a certain pattern of output coming out of the system, and there's an algorithm, which is a set of rules within the system that does the matching. So an algorithm completely lacks meaning. And what I mean by that is, say, for example, you have a computer program that is a word processor, like Microsoft Word. I type things into Microsoft Word on my keyboard, and letters appear on my screen on my computer. Mm-hmm. So that's a nice computation. The input is my typing. The algorithm is the word processing program. And the output is the letters on my screen. Mm-hmm. The thing is that the program is blind to meaning. That is, I can type, I believe global warming is true, and it pops up on my screen. I can then type, I believe global warming is false, and that pops up on my screen. Microsoft Word doesn't care about the opinion that I express using it. Microsoft Word lacks any reference to meaning. You can type any essay you want, and it would put it out just fine. Mm-hmm. So computation lacks meaning. It's a mechanical process of taking a signal, making it into a different signal according to rules that has nothing to do with meaning. And the mind always has meaning.
Right.
Every thought is what philosophers have called intentional, meaning that every thought is directed at something, has a meaning. Like when you say, I'm thinking, you always mean you're thinking about something. There's always an aboutness to it. And computation never has an aboutness. Your word processor is not about anything. It's just a word processor. It matches a keystroke to a letter on a screen. So not only is the mind not a computer, it's the opposite of a computer.
Yeah, and it's what makes computers possible. It's funny, we sort of impose the analogy of the mind onto the computer at first, then we forgot we imposed that analogy. Then we impose the analogy of a computer on us, right?
Sure. And actually, if you think about it, if computation had meaning, because what that would mean was that every different meaning you'd want to type into a word processor would need a different set of software.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So what makes computers so useful is that they're blank slates.
Right.
They don't have meaning. Mm-hmm. Now, the question though is the brain a computer? Mm-hmm. For a dualist, the mind is not the same thing as the brain.
Right.
So is the brain a computer? Well, you could say that. I mean, that at least to one level of insight, that we have inputs, perceptions, and so on, and then we have outputs like emotions or speech or something. And you say, well, yeah, maybe it's like a computer, but you have to be careful about that. The reason is that one of my favorite quotes in science. This is a brilliant insight by Werner Heisenberg, who Nobel laureate, was a pioneer in quantum mechanics back in the 1930s and 40s. And Heisenberg at one point commented, looking at all the strange things in quantum mechanics, he said, what we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. Mm. So that if you study the brain as if it were a computer, well, by golly, it'll seem like a computer. It's an artifact of how you're studying it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean the brain is a computer. It means that, yeah, if you use a computational framework
to
do neuroscience, and hey, computational neuroscience is a big deal. I mean, there's a lot of neuroscience is computational. If you use a computational framework, lo and behold, it'll seem like the brain's a computer. It doesn't mean it's really a computer. Right. It's kind of interesting that thousands of years ago, some of the early philosophers thought that the brain was like fire because it was hot. The head is warm, relatively speaking. So they thought the brain was like a radiator and generated heat. So and then back in the early modern era, when machines first became widely available, people thought the brain was like a machine, and now we think it's like a computer. So every era tries to make the brain seem like what they know something about.
That's
fire,
right.
Mm-hmm. Machines, computers. But as Heisenberg said, what we observe in our science is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning.
Yeah, that is a great quote. So as a, you know, fully fruitful theory of mind, the computational theory leaves a lot to be desired, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's one way of studying it, and I have a lot of respect for that. I mean, I frankly, my own area of research is computational study of brain blood flow.
Yeah.
Hey, it's great, but I don't think brain blood flow is a computer, but it's a method. It's like if you're studying astronomy using a telescope, mm-hmm. you wouldn't come to the conclusion that stars were little bits of light that come through curved glass.
Yes. Yeah. Good point.
You shouldn't confuse your instrument
right.
with the thing you're studying.
Yeah. Or don't turn your method into a metaphysics.
Precisely. Yeah. And so the instrument that people use is computational models, which are very, very interesting models. But that doesn't mean the brain is a computer.
Yeah, excellent.
So, and then you get into the question of artificial general intelligence.
Yes, the hot one today, right? Yeah.
That's a hot one. And as you can imagine, I have very strong feelings about AI. The first feeling I have is that, of course, AI is not conscious and can never be conscious.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that can be conscious is a living thing with a soul. And AI is not a living thing. It doesn't have a soul, so it's not conscious. It's just silly. It's what St. Thomas would call an artifact.
It's an artifact. You know,
it's something we've constructed. So AI is not conscious in the same way that your watch doesn't know what time it is. Right? I mean, you can tell time using your watch. It's a nice tool. It's a good instrument. But the watch itself doesn't know what time it is. It doesn't know anything. It's just a piece of metal.
Mm-hmm.
So a computer, no matter how complex it is, doesn't know anything. It's just a physical object that we've constructed. It can seem like it knows things because we can construct it in ways that are very clever.
Yes.
But everything that comes out of it is what we've put into it. The problem is that we don't always understand what we put in. So what comes out of it seems like it has a life of its own,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't. And I think AI is going to be an extremely important and extremely dangerous thing, in part because we will come, it will outrun its creators. It will outrun its creators in the sense that it will do things that we don't understand and that we will attribute to it when these are really us. The meme that I use with that is that AI is us. And it's just it's us in a very complex labyrinthine processed way, but it's still just us. And people who understand that can use AI to manipulate us.
Yes.
And they will, and they are.
yeah. Certainly, it's a powerful tool in many ways. It's a useful tool, but it is one that has raised much concern among many people, including myself.
I think of AI, frankly, as an idol.
Oh yeah, sure.
AI is something that mankind has created, and ultimately will worship. There's an old joke that gets to this actually, about a mad scientist who is a brilliant guy, and he decides he's going to create the world's smartest computer that can answer any question.
Mm-hmm.
So he makes this incredible computer that just processes incredibly fast and it's wonderful. And he asks it all kinds of questions about theory of relativity and blah, blah, blah. And it's all great. So finally he says, I'm going to ask the ultimate question of this computer. So he asks the computer, is there a God? And the computer answers, there is now.
Oh.
And that's our problem, is that we will ultimately ask AI, is there a God? And it will tell us there is now.
Yeah.
And we will end up worshiping it. And it's the ultimate idol. And it's no coincidence that the first usable personal computer was what? It was an Apple.
Ah, yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
We've
taken a bite out of a new kind of apple.
Yeah. Yeah. Really fascinating. I appreciate these sort of wider cultural predictions, Mike. I share many of the same sorts of feelings. And as somebody who does, you know, make regular use of the various AI software program, including ChatGPT, If you spend enough time with those things, and especially if you're, you know, working with various complex concepts, it doesn't take long for you to realize that this is not a thinking thing, honestly.
Exactly. It's plastered together.
Yeah, but great for people who want, you know, more on AI. This podcast has an enormous amount of material and conversations on that. But it's always great to, you know, just to have your perspective on that, Mike. Do you have another common question or two for us before we wrap this segment up? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one more that's pretty common, and it's I think a very interesting question is, did the mind evolve? And Darwinian ideas about how life came to be what it is obviously play a very big role in our society and science. And I'm very much an anti-Darwinist. I think Darwinism is junk science.
Yeah.
But many people will ask, well, did the mind evolve? And whether or not the body can evolve is a whole separate question, but the mind by its very nature cannot evolve. And the reason is quite simple. The mind has immaterial powers. It has spiritual powers. And that's what, you know, Penfield found, what Sperry found, what all these researchers have found, is that there's an immaterial, like spiritual aspect mm-hmm. of the human mind. And of course, you can't evolve something spiritual by Darwinian mechanisms. Natural selection and heritable variation only work on things like genes and DNA. They don't work on ideas.
Right.
They don't work on abstract thought. Mm-hmm. And so the mind could not evolve, which corresponds very nicely to the traditional Catholic teaching on the nature of the human soul, that whatever one believes about Darwinian evolution for the body, the human soul is created at the moment of conception by God.
That's right. Yeah. Every single individual. Mm-hmm.
Souls don't evolve and they can't evolve.
Yeah. So people can take whatever position they want on Darwinism, but the nature of the mind itself is not something that is susceptible to that. Right.
And I think that the church is far too friendly to Darwinism. As I said, I think Darwinism is utter garbage, but you know, that's a whole separate discussion. But when it comes to the mind, Darwinian mechanisms have no traction whatsoever on the mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's good. It's good to have at least those firm lines, both philosophical and theological. So that's fantastic. We will hit pause again here with our conversation with Dr. Michael Egnor on neuroscience in the soul. So everybody stay tuned for part 3. We will be back shortly.
This has been Mind Matters News. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.